Yale produced a great report a few years ago on slavery and abolition in Yale. And at Trinity, we took that report and did something like that for our college called On Zion, Racism at Trinity College. But I tried to find out what's happened at Yale since that report came out, and apparently not much. Let that be for the Yale students, at least an edge for the struggle. You know this report? You know, which documented that, all the houses, you know, people are called master still, and, you know, and, yeah, it's serious. And the houses are named after, you know, well-known slavers. At Trinity, we found that one of our houses, or actually buildings, we don't have houses, we're not that famous. We have buildings. One of our buildings was named after somebody who was a member of the American Nazi Party. It's a curious business how buildings are named, but history is embodied in those structures. Get with it. You know, we need to change some of these things, especially master. I mean, what's that? Especially since, the bulk of the working force on campus are black and Latino. It's a peculiar thing that you have white faculty called master by a black and Latino working community, that's every day leaned on by the college. It's a weird sort of thing. 2003, my friends, a peculiar world. Anyway, here's what I decided to do. I decided to do two things. One is to take us a little distance away from disparities within South Asian America. I wanted to try to offer us some kind of program, some kind of idea of what in the larger struggle for social justice the disparities within South Asian America mean. What is the big picture for us? I wanted to spend some time on that. The other thing I wanted to spend some time on is what can students do? The fact is that most people here are on college campuses. What can people on college campuses do in our struggle for social justice? In our struggle against the monster, bated breath, waiting to bomb, 23 million Iraqis, etc. What can we do on college campuses? So that's the second thing I'm interested in. But before I get there, keep in mind that this winter, I'm just going to India for a minute, this winter, the Indian government convened, you heard about this, the Diaspora Day? Big ceremony. Ravi Shankar played music, V.S. Naipaul was acerbic and annoying as usual, But his wife, Nadira Naipaul, stood up to the Advani, the, deputy prime minister, and said, what about Gujarat? Which was stunning, coming from the Naipaul family. But still, significant. In a sense, that was, to my mind, a waste of energy. Once again, the powers that be, the establishment, celebrated the money makers, the people who get picked up by white supremacy as our leaders. Not necessarily people that we ourselves offer up as leaders, but people that they somehow deem to be leaders, the money makers, the Sanjay Kumars of the world, people whose hands are dipped in, the corrupt tills of Enron, in a way. They were picked to come and speak and talk about what the diaspora meant. Where were the representatives of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance in Delhi? Where were the representatives from Workers Awaz? Where were the cannery workers? Where were the workers in the cane fields of Trinidad? They had no place at the Great Diaspora Day, even though the diaspora, we know, globally, is not really just about Silicon Valley, right? The diaspora globally is about the working class, say, in Fiji, in Trinidad, in Guyana, in Great Britain, and certainly, in the United States. You couldn't buy a newspaper in New York on the street if it weren't for, say, some Bangladeshi brother or sister standing there, 24 hours a day, pretty much. I don't know how they go to the toilet, but they're there in those kiosks, selling papers to us. It's a dreadful job, but they do it, But where was their representative, in New Delhi? In a sense, the New Delhi meeting was their Davos, like the World Economic Forum. And in a sense, gatherings like this are our Porto Alegre. And we need to see it like that. This is our gathering for the World Diaspora Day. This should be the small steps that we take to convene later, a diaspora meeting of the South Asian, left maybe, progressives, working class, whatever it might be, but globally as well. links more than just within the United States. Although this is enormous, I went to Radical South Asia at Vassar, you know, and that was well organized. First step, and this is the second, much bigger, you know, people from all kinds of colleges. But then we need to take another step, you know, and think about across the waters. So let me just begin with the first, you know, task that I set for myself, a program, trying to think of inequality to, or disparities within South Asian America in a larger frame. And in a sense, for me, that larger frame is around the term neoliberalism. You know, the form that that global capitalism has taken since the 1970s. And there are four aspects that I'm going to share with you and try to show a little bit about how these four aspects are so central to the dilemmas that all of us face, you know, being South Asian American in the U.S. and living with the disparities and economic inequalities in our community and other inequalities in our community. So let me give you four aspects. By the way, I've always thought that neoliberalism can be dated to 1974, you know, when the Nobel Prize, I mean, that's probably the worst prize for us to get excited about, you know, and I was happy when Amartya Sen won the Nobel Prize, but, you know, big deal. So many other people do good economics, they'll never get the prize, you know. He symbolized something good about progressive economics, and it's good he won the prize. In 1974, the Nobel Committee gave the prize to two people. One was Gunnar Myrdal, who was the, you know, the writer of Asian Dilemma, what is it, Asia Drama. He wrote the book about race in America. You know, he's an old social democrat from Scandinavia. He was given the prize almost as a nod to yesterday. He was yesterday's news, the social democratic consensus, you know, of a big government, where the state has a responsibility to its people, etc. They gave that to him almost as a parting shot to something which the Nobel Committee and the establishment decided was yesterday's news. The prize was shared with a man called Friedrich Hayek, F.A. Hayek. Hayek was, in 1944, wrote a book called The Road to Serfdom. Basically, this is what Hayek believes. Hayek believes that if you try to make social justice in the world, you'll end up being authoritarian. You understand? If you try to produce goodness in the world, you'll end up being a fascist. In other words, what's the recommendation from Hayek? Don't do anything. Free markets and absolute irresponsibility from the population. He was the second to win the Nobel Prize in 74, and he was the voice of the future, in a way. He became, you know, Margaret Thatcher's intellectual guru and leading force in the world as far as this idea that developed, you know, from England, but then elsewhere, TINA, there is no alternative. You know, that was Margaret Thatcher's phrase. There is no alternative to multinational capitalism essentially dominating everybody's lives, where trying to make a difference in the world is itself the problem. You know, Hayek wrote that chasing social justice is to chase a mirage. You know, in other words, we have to just live with the trash that we're bequeathed. You know, yesterday's history is basically our today. There's nothing you can do about it. It's the most depressing form of you know, social ideology. And by the way, you know, when people say, why aren't students protesting, you know, now like they used to? I mean, the fact is that's wrong, because the students are protesting in large numbers now. But also, think about this. The establishment tells us that the only ideology worthwhile is the ideology of individually making money. You know, we don't have people above giving us different visions, which doesn't mean the visions don't exist in the world. They come from different places. But it's those same people then, hypocritically, who'll say, where are the people? You know, where's the idealism in the youth? Well, obviously, you killed it, you understand, partly. I mean, you've destroyed in the academy any ability for people with a straight face to talk about social justice, etc. You know, it's like we roll our eyes back and go, God, another bleeding heart, you know, another idiot talking about ending poverty, you know. It's all very well, you live in a big house, you're talking big about, you know, ending poverty. We've made all these, you know, gestures so that it's almost impossible to talk the good talk, you know, and fight the good fight. You can probably see that on your campuses, you know. It's like people are, oh, God, you're going to protest the war. What's next? You know, what are you protesting next? You know, okay, AIDS yesterday, war tomorrow, you know. I mean, that's ridiculous. Michael Berube, so-called progressive, wrote in that terrible magazine, and I encourage you never to read it, The Chronicle of Higher Education. He wrote an article in there where he essentially said, you know, all these people come to demonstrations. Some are for, you know, macrobiotic food. Some are for this. Some are for that. But what's wrong with that? You know, what's wrong with believing in something? You know, it may seem funny to the cynic who has enough cash to, you know, shop at Whole Foods. But for the rest of us, you know, we believe in these things. And what's wrong with belief? And that's a huge thing to fight, because neoliberalism has done four different things which has taken the legs out of our struggle. And let me just go over the four different things. They're all related, and this is totally schematic, and most of you probably know all this stuff better because you study at good schools where they teach you all this stuff, but let me go over it anyway. You know, the first thing that happens from the 1970s is that the welfare state is destroyed. You know, Clinton might have had the bad taste to end welfare as we know it in 1996, but actually welfare was destroyed in the 70s. You know, they stopped funding welfare. They started things called midnight raids. You know this thing? What's a midnight raid? You know, AFDC. If you get AFDC, a single woman with a child, the government would raid your house to see if there was a man there at night. You know, if there was a man there, you stopped getting your check. I mean, authoritarian, repressive ways to basically cut back on social welfare. Anyway, they had stopped indexing a lot of these things to inflation. So the value of things like the welfare check had declined dramatically. This is just the United States. Look around the world. I mean, the underfunding of education from the 70s. You know, we blame the IMF and the World Bank, correct? You know, we say that they, on the one hand, in Pakistan, were telling the state in the 70s and 80s, stop funding, you know, we don't want to see state-funded education. Well, obviously, the kids were going to go to the madrasa. You know, there's no state-funded education. All you had was the private sector, what Bush loves to call faith-based education. Well, in Pakistan, my friend, faith-based education is the madrasa. You know, so that's what happened there. Here, the same kind of thing. Let's privatize schooling. Let's break down the public sector and everything. Privatize the water supply. Privatize, you know, electricity. We got Enron. Privatize the water supply in Argentina. In two cities, there was water poisoning because companies like Bechtel were out there trying to produce water on the cheap. So the first aspect was the destruction of the social welfare state. You know, and you see that around the world from the 70s. Okay? This is obvious, right? You know, anybody who goes to a public school recognizes immediately the great disparities that exist and continue to exist. And there are students here from UMass Amherst. A college there is being assassinated, right? Is it being assassinated? I think so. We got a new chancellor, right? Mr. Lombardi. You know, what is he going to do? They're building a big biotech thing. They got a $2 million, what was it? It was like a thing from some trustee, wrote $2 or $6 million check. They're going to build up biotech, but not the undergraduate education. Forget undergraduate education, that's yesterday's news. You know, make the students pay more. So that's the first aspect, the end of social welfare. Second aspect, you see, academics will tell you, and smart people who come on MSNBC will tell you, that the state since the 1970s has been shrinking. Don't they say that? You know, the state is shrinking. It's the end of the state. Now we're a transnational world. If the state is shrinking, why is the second aspect of neoliberalism so important? The second aspect is the increase of the repressive function of the state. Hello, did you see the new budget? Bush increased the military budget last year by 14%. This year by what? 6%. It's astounding. I mean, when you think about how the military here gets, what, $400 billion, and apparently, according to Chalmers Johnson, that's only 40% of what they really get. Chalmers Johnson, who wrote a great book called Blowback, argues that 60% of the military budget is secret. And, you know, I don't see why I should not believe him. You may want to turn to Daniel Ellsberg. You know this guy, Daniel Ellsberg? Everybody should know Daniel Ellsberg. He's the guy who worked for the Rand Corporation and in the 1970s stole this history of the Vietnam War and gave it to the, well, actually the New York Times burgled his brother-in-law's apartment and took what became the Pentagon Papers. His book is out this year. It's called Secrets, Daniel Ellsberg. He was a man inside the establishment. There's a lot of things we don't know about the military apparatus. The repressive function, not only the military, but also police forces. I mean, New Haven, you know, come on, you know. Hartford, where I live, you know, anytime there's any so-called trouble, you know, we have semi-automatic rifles on the street, you know, from the police. You know, we have the fear of gangs. I mean, come on, if you're black in Hartford, the fear is the fear of the police. On my campus, a student, white student was knifed, apparently. See, whenever there's a knifing on campus, nobody talks about the drug sales on campus. You know, why is a student getting knifed on campus? You know, why is somebody in there in his room at night and then he gets knifed and this person leaves? And the student says it was a black person came in, etc., knifed me. Okay? No discussion about drugs. Immediately, my campus brought armed police, Hartford police on campus. What starts to happen to students of color on campus? White students are closing the doors on them. You understand? Security for some is not security for all, right? You bring campus police on campus, the white students feel more secure. Nobody else seems to, you know? And certainly, it sends a terrible message about, say, town-gown relations. You understand? The second aspect of neoliberalism is an increase of the repressive function around the world. You know, this includes things like the USA Patriot Act. How many people now held, you know, in detention, so-called? By the way, it's not just the United States. In India, we have this great thing called POTA, you know, Prevention of Terrorism Act now. It used to be ordinance. In Britain, they had a stringent act against so-called terrorism. By the way, when they talk about terrorism, half the time they want to bust anybody who doesn't agree with them. You know, when people decided, you know, to hold a protest against the World Economic Forum in New York City, you know, they held, it's normally at Davos. Last year they held it in New York. There was a big protest, and immediately the administration said, we won't allow terrorists to come near the site of the World Economic Forum. In other words, anybody who doesn't agree with us is a terrorist. You know, be careful with what we start to go along with these administrations around the world. They're increasing the repressive apparatus, telling us that it's for our security. The question is, whose security, you know, and who's going to benefit by having to live under such an enormous military? By the way, a great example of this is Barry McCaffrey. You remember him, Barry McCaffrey? In his body, he embodies both domestic and international repression. Barry McCaffrey, who was he? The drug czar. What else was he? He was a general. What was his most famous battle experience? Anybody remember this? It was 10 years ago, mind you. So it was in the first Gulf War. The Iraqis had called for a ceasefire, and the American military accepted the ceasefire. Actually, the Allied command accepted the ceasefire. The Iraqis were retreating along a road in an area called Rumaila, where the large oil fields were. They began to retreat. Barry McCaffrey was heading a battalion stationed there, and they decided to shoot against the retreating Iraqis, and they killed thousands, they say tens of thousands of Iraqi troops. The New Yorker reported this in 1991. Seymour Hersh of the New Yorker broke this story. It was called the Road of Blood, the Massacre of Rumaila. Nobody cares about this, though. Barry McCaffrey, repression internationally. You think they're going to use precision bombs against Iraq? Already on NPR today, they were talking about Takriti, the town where Saddam Hussein comes from, is going to be obliterated. You know, very openly they said the plan is to obliterate the town. Well, precision bombing in Afghanistan, probably more civilians died, they say, in Afghanistan than died in the 9/11 attacks in the United States. More civilians died. Then we need to count how many people are suffering. You know, like that Pakistani man who was pulled off a train. If you take India Abroad newspaper, it had a wonderful story about this Pakistani man who was removed from a train. He's now in Hyderabad, but he was held for 6 or 7 months in solitary confinement in the United States, and he was tortured, water torture, they held him upside down, etc. Kept saying, you're a terrorist, and he said, I'm not a terrorist. You know, they said, you had a box cutter on you. It's like, you know, it's like a Swiss Army knife. They said that, you know, you had all this, you're Arab, you're Arabic. That's what they were yelling, you're Arabic. Well, he had some Urdu letters and an Urdu book in his bag. You're Arabic. He said, I'm not Arabic, I'm Indian. He's now in Hyderabad. He says, I never want to come back here again. That's a casualty of war. The repressive function has increased unbelievably. And by the way, that's also been privatized. You know, Wackenhut Corporation owns prisons, etc. Just like the state now doesn't even hold people, it wants to privatize even that function. Secondly, the repressive function has increased. So we've had a decrease in the state's desire to create social justice or social welfare, but an increase of its repressive aspect. The third thing, it's important, the third part is important. The third part is, just when we are told about fiscal rectitude, you know, you need to be fiscally, what, you know, conservative, balance the budget, etc. Forget this budget deficit. It actually isn't huge, $300 billion. You know, we have an enormous budget. But forget that. this is nothing really, you know. It's a red herring. The Democratic Party always finds the smallest thing to get worked up about. The bigger issue, military funding, they'll say nothing. They'll get worked up about, you know, some little detail. You know, I mean, I'm not really that big on balancing the budget either. It's a very conservative economic thing to be doing for a government, you know, because it means that they're going to slash social programs, essentially, because that's how, you know, this logic works. But corporate welfare will increase. Just when they say that people need to take care of themselves, you know, the first aspect, they cut back on social welfare, corporate welfare increases. I wrote this book, which is actually out on Enron. Enron, when Enron went outside the United States, it didn't spend even $1 of its own capital. It was essentially financed by development corporations. The United States government gave Enron $4 billion to do most of its shenanigans around the world, $3.68 billion. You know, so did the Asian Development Bank, you know, the big so-called development entity. OPIC, Overseas, whatever it is, industrial corporation, you know, headed by who? You know, Tom Harkin, Senate, Democratic, supposedly liberal senator from Iowa. His wife, Ruth Harkin, is the head of OPIC, which gives away money to big corporations, essentially, to go and do business overseas. To be like Enron overseas, by the way. Enron in India was a disgraceful story. You followed this story? Enron essentially destroyed the capacity of the Maharashtra government to do anything like budgeting, you know. I mean, you know, it was like a shakedown. You have to pay us X amount of dollars in dollars, regardless of whether you use even a tenth of the services that we provide. It was called a power purchasing agreement. It was essentially a shakedown financed by the United States government. Let me give you one small Enron story. In Mozambique, half of Mozambique's budget is covered by U.S. aid, by the way, a country devastated by civil war. You know, destroyed by civil war and now rebuilding. But half of their budget, annual budget, is covered by U.S. aid. Mozambique was going to open a gas pipeline. The biggest bid, the best bid, came from the South African government. You know, there's this whole South African region, Southern African regional development thing. Enron showed up and said, "We'll do it. We have a bid for you." Mozambican government was not that interested. Anthony Lake, who was former national security advisor, calls up the head of the pertinent division in Mozambique of mining and minerals and says that either you give Enron the contract or we will slow down on USAID money to you. In other words, strict blackmail. So-called aid money from the United States, which anyway isn't large, is used to leverage entry of American-based corporations or dollar-dependent corporations in the so-called third world. Secondly, those firms arrive there and then get more U.S. money to buy ancillary goods and services from the United States. So very rarely do they help develop, you know, industry in the countries they enter. Bechtel in Bolivia, great story. You know, privatized the water supply in Cochabamba. You've got to follow this story. It's tremendous. You know, the Cochabambinos threw out Bechtel, which is a U.S.-based company. You know, but they claim to be based in Holland because now they're suing Bolivia. It's a great story. But they actually won there. They threw out the privatization of the water supply. Okay, so corporate welfare is acceptable. You know, and look at this. After Enron, after all these corporate collapses, what's happened? Nothing. You know, basically, we've seen nothing. John McCain, who's crazy. I mean, he's literally crazy. He's a U.S. senator. Interview in the New York Times magazine, you know, where they have the photograph of the person and the 10 questions or whatever. They say, "What would you like to see with the corporate executive?" He said, "I'd like them all hung." He's a sitting senator, you know, it's weird. But nothing has happened to them. Nothing has happened to them. You know, one or two people get charged, but basically it's business as usual, you know, for corporate America. The same givebacks, the same giveaways, the same principles that have produced inequality in the first place are now continuing. Guess what the president wants to do as stimulus? Dividends. No tax on dividends, etc. This benefits who? You? Not you. It benefits the big fat cats of the world, you know. So corporate welfare, the third aspect. The fourth aspect is basically how our world, because most of us are entering periods of grave economic insecurity, you know, and, you know, okay, I make a decent salary, I'm tenured at Trinity, but, you know, we're on a pay freeze, which to me is like, my God, a pay freeze? What about inflation and, you know, need to buy things, send money home, you know. It's all those worrying things, but you know, economic insecurity is hitting even people like myself. And certainly when you try to find a job, it'll hit you in a huge way, you know. And I think of myself as a privileged person, you know, having a full-time job, basically can't be fired unless, you know, I do something egregious. But I feel the economic insecurity, and, you know, most of my students are feeling it in a big way. If there is more economic insecurity, how do we, you know, not just go on the street and either start committing suicide like the people in Andhra Pradesh and in South America, the farmers who have been committing suicide, drinking pesticide? You know, it's a tragic, tragic story in Andhra Pradesh, in India. Thousands of farmers in the last 3 years have been drinking pesticide and committing suicide. This was a story broken by P. Sainath, the journalist, you know, wonderful series he wrote on suicides in Andhra Pradesh. It's the same thing happening in South America. In Brazil, in the Amazon region, people have been committing suicide, the Guarani Indians, for years because their land is being taken. They're committing suicide and the whole family is killing themselves. It's a tragic condition. Why is it that we're all not doing this? You know, why is it that we're not committing suicide like, say, those crazy young kids, Palestinian kids, who are doing what I think is a horrible thing, but, you know, they're not crazy in a sense because they're also having to deal with a terrible occupation. Committing suicide in a different way, taking people with them. It's a horrible, horrible condition to be in. Why are we all not doing this? Because, in a sense, we're all buying into the cultural conservatism that comes from neoliberalism and makes us, you know, not feel angry with the powers that be, but feel angry with maybe our neighbors. You know, that's the third aspect, cultural conservatism. How does that work out? By the way, Trent Lott left. If you think of cultural conservatism, Trent Lott left. But the same week, President Bush brought on in his cabinet Jon Snow, and to head the SEC, William Davidson, Donaldson. They come from, Snow comes from CSX, and Donaldson comes from Aetna. The first reparations lawsuit filed last year, you know, on behalf of African Americans, the companies charged with benefiting from slavery, from enslavement, were CSX and Aetna. Great, you know, message sent by George Bush to his hooded friends, you know, to explain to them that all is fine even though Lott is gone. You know, the same kind of triangulation of the right takes place in places like India, Pakistan, etc., Egypt, you know, Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism, Hindutva, you know, this kind of Protestantist fundamentalism in the United States. You know, these forms of cultural conservatism are exactly the kind of social glue that neoliberalism uses around the world to maintain solidarity among people so they don't actually challenge the system. You know, so that it's easier for lower middle class young men and women in India, for instance, to, you know, get into this whole Hindutva thing and start believing that it's the Muslims who are the problem and not, say, the Ambanis, not the IMF, not the George Bushes, etc. In fact, Bush becomes the ally of a lower middle class person in Ahmedabad, lower middle class Hindu, against their Muslim neighbors. You see how this works. It's perverse. Or out of work Israelis see Sharon as their ally, see Bush as their ally, and see Palestinians across the Green Line as the enemy. You know, Israel has a high unemployment problem, but that will not be addressed. Because the single issue that Sharon ran on was that we have to deal with Palestinian terror. Terrorism becomes the bogey, and cultural conservatism becomes an easy way, basically, to maintain social solidarity. And South Asian America, by the way, is past masters at all four aspects of neoliberalism. You know, you can see the last one easily. Did any of you follow the campaign against the IDRF, the India Development, you know, you didn't follow that? It's an interesting campaign. A group of, you know, pretty regular folk, you know, decided to research the India Development and Relief Foundation and found that, you know, almost, what, more than 85% of its money goes to organizations of the Hindu right in India. Many of them, you know, pretty virulent organizations. There's a character that I found most distasteful, Swami Ashim Anand, who basically was the organizer of the Bajrang Dal in Gujarat. And, you know, they were the frontline people to be there in the killing of Muslims. So, you know, how is it that our community in the United States gets turned on to Hindutva? You know, why are we moving in culturally conservative directions? You know, is that the social solidarity and glue that's helping us maintain some stability in the world when the rug is being pulled out from under our feet, when repression increases? You know, state repression has increased against all South Asians. Muslims are getting it hardest. I don't agree that this is racial profiling against South Asians. I think this is McCarthyism against Muslims. You know, they're going after mosques. They're going after anybody with a Muslim name. You know, sure, I mean, you have a hard time getting on a plane or on the train. You know, those are small inconveniences compared to the kind of attack being borne by Muslims in the United States. So it's kind of easy then to say, if you're a Hindu, you know, in the U.S., to say, you know, I'm not a Muslim. The Indian Consul General after 9/11 in New York, do you know what they said in their release, their report, or whatever, their advisory to the South Asians in America? Mainly, I guess, they were interested in Indians. They said women should wear bindis. You know. I mean, I just read that and I was like, well, what do I do? You know, maybe I should wear a bindi too. You know, it's, but you see how it works. It's pernicious. You know, you deny, you're the Judas, you know, the Desi Judas. You deny Muslims. You say, I'm not a Muslim. I don't worship in a mosque. I don't believe in them. You start talking three times as more virulently against Islam and against 9/11 than your white neighbors. Your white neighbors will be embarrassed by you. Cultural conservatism in the increase, you understand, in our communities. By the way, India Abroad newspaper, fantastic coverage. Suleiman Deen, I don't know if you read this paper. Maybe you should. You know, this guy, he wrote a beautifully moving piece on what it means to be Muslim in America today and what it means to be a brown man in America today. Moving. Special registration. You know, if any of you are from Pakistan or Bangladesh, our friends, India is next on the list. You know, we have to register. I mean, this is ridiculous. But we'll go along with this relatively quiescently. Why? Because the problem for the majority of South Asian Americans, that is for Hindus, is the Muslim. Cultural conservatism is an easy way to trump state repression. You know, the state gets away without criticism. We talk about the economy. I mean, it's ridiculous. Just because there are a handful of South Asians that do well, the rest of us feel like we shouldn't talk about, you know, inequality in the United States, that it screens off inequality. You know, just because IIT, the Indian Institute of Technology, celebrated its 50 years anniversary and Bill Gates spoke so glowingly of all those people who worked pretty much for free for him. You know, that's why he's interested in IIT. You know, Indian government is essentially one of the last places that supports a major technical and research school for undergraduates, right? MIT and such are funded by who? By military contractors. I mean, it's not a state college, right? Indian government pays for these people. You get trained in the best kind of technical education. You show up in the United States and work pretty much for free for Microsoft or for, you know, body shoppers like Tata Consultancy. But our communities essentially screen off criticism of capitalism by saying that one or two of us have made it, and you know, because you guys win spelling bees, you might make it as well. Let's not criticize capitalism. Let's essentially try to win in the system. You know, the most pernicious way to disregard and disrespect those people who are struggling every day to make a living. So cultural conservatism screens off, you know, economic inequalities. Do we as a community fight for an increase in welfare? Has our community taken a public stand for affirmative action? Where are those leaders who went to New Delhi, you know, to talk big about the diaspora? Did they make any statement about affirmative action? None. But in the 70s, it was the ancestors of these very people that fought to get South Asians considered as minorities so that they could get access to minority contracts. It was these same people who benefited from that and now turn their back on the system and tell us that, you know, actually affirmative action hurts Asians. You hear this stuff all the time? If there was no affirmative action, there'd be more Asians, you know, because we're so brilliant, you know, essentially. And black and Latino students are taking up spaces for us. Nobody criticizes white students because they are self-evidently, you know, belong, you know. This is the pernicious way in which divide and conquer works. Cultural conservatism, basically to screen off the killing off of the welfare state, the first aspect. We're in some deep problems if we don't fight these things, you know, as a community. And if we don't consolidate something like a left within the South Asian community, you know, I mean, I'm a self-proclaimed lefty. I'm never one to talk about I'm a liberal or I'm a progressive or, you know, I mean, that's ridiculous, you know. Anytime I talk to people, you know, in the media or something, they're always like, you know, so, you know, what's the left-wing perspective, you know? You go, ha-ha, you know, it's like a big joke, you know. It's like, we'll talk to the right-wingers and the soft right and the hard right, and we'll take them all seriously. So, you know, Mr. Agnihotri, sir, you know, sir, what do you believe, sir? You know, I mean, it's amazing. You know, they give these people the time of day and they talk to them seriously, but because we haven't made a strong showing, except, by the way, this IDRF campaign really rocked them. You know, the letters page in all the major magazines and periodicals, it rocked them. They didn't realize, you know, so that now the bitter hate campaign against the left is picked up. But that's good. You know, it's a good thing that they are so, you know, feeling, you know, put on the back burner. So let me switch to the second part of what I wanted to say. I have about 20 minutes to go. And the second part is about what we can do, given this, you know, terrible, appalling situation, right? And I'm not a pessimist, you know, I'm generally an optimist. So the picture I've painted for you is actually, I think, you know, rather muted. You know, people could paint worse pictures, you know, Armageddon-type pictures, but I think of this as the rose-tinted version, you know. Here's what I think we need to be doing. You know, at Wesleyan, I was there a few years ago, and Max Mishler, your colleague and friend, you know, we were having a conversation, and he said something very insightful, which, you know, I think many of you have been thinking about for years, you know, I hope, that there are really two kinds of students who are involved on campuses. Remember this? He went on this at length. It was an insightful point. There are two kinds of students on campus. On the one hand, there are students that do community service, right? Plenty of students. They do good community service. They're out there doing ESL classes. What else do students do? What else do some of you do? Community service. Pick up trash. Exactly. What else? Habitat for Humanity. What else? Feed the homeless. You know, in this day and age, it's extraordinary that people are doing these things. Right? I mean, it's like you cannot disrespect the fact that people do community. One lot of students do community service. There's a second lot, and frequently these are different communities, and they look down upon each other. They often disdain each other, you know. You might see if this is true. Hey, the second lot of students that are there are the politicos, you know, the political students who go to the rallies, right? What else? What else do the political students do? Take over buildings. What else? Worker solidarity, what else? Petitions, teach-ins, anti-war rallies, organizing buses, etc. What Max said that day, which was insightful, is that the politicos need to do more community service, and the community service folk need to do more politics. This is the dialectical opposite that needs to come together. This is what you need to be the crucible for on your campuses. You know, you have to stop allowing the political students to make fun of community service people as reformers. Because those are the people that have access to the working class. They are probably the only ones on affluent college campuses who take the time to cross class. You understand? Who spend sustained amount of their time working in homeless shelters, working in workers, you know, maybe they go and, you know, intern at trade unions, whatever it is. You know, they spend time doing all that stuff, and they cannot be disrespected for that. On the other hand, the community service students look at the political students and think these people are basically, you know, this is like Martians, you know, the Reds who don't make a difference in the world. All they do is scream and shout, you know, the real impact is teach, etc. That's also an absurd position, because both communities need each other and need to become more similar. You know, we need to spend way more time, you know, getting off the campus, at the same time bringing that back to the campus. You know, it's insufficient just to go off campus and not bring it back on the campus. You know, campuses need to understand its imbrication in class politics. You know, how a college campus essentially is about, is a neoliberal environment. You know, its non-profit organization pays no taxes, doesn't care about its community as such, and then gives like a little bit of money and big hoo-ha about, you know, town-gown relations. You know, we bring students from the high schools to the, you know, library on Saturday at midnight, you know, or something, you know. It's a big hoo-ha, it's a tiny little thing. They don't pay taxes. It's an enormous benefit that they get off the backs of people who live in these cities. You know, secondly, huge police forces, many of them armed, you know, enormous police forces, many of the police forces are armed. The University of Chicago, where I had the misfortune of getting my graduate degree from, has the third largest, the university had the third largest police force in the state of Illinois. Chicago had the largest. Springfield, I think, Bonnie, was that the second? Or maybe we were the second largest. Yeah, it was extraordinary. It's a tiny campus. You walk anywhere and there's, you know, my friend Pradeep Jagannathan, who would, work in the computer center, God only knows why, until late in the night. It was a dark-skinned man, would walk home to our apartment. And, you know, he was one of these guys who was, you know, I guess curious, so I don't know what he was, but he used to walk and he'd look into cars occasionally. You know, I mean, you know, he's got his backpack and he'd be looking in, you know, prowling around. Almost every night he'd be picked up by the police. Almost every night. He never touched a car. Almost every night, you know. The repressive function on campuses are extraordinary. And, you know, not only do the community know that, but students of color know that on campus, right? How many times have you get mistaken, you know, for somebody that you're not supposed to be, you know? The third thing, obviously, corporate welfare doesn't fully apply, but cultural conservatism certainly. Look at what they teach us now on campuses. I mean, okay, more and more, we're supposed to be more, increasingly, maybe not, you know, at some of your schools, but increasingly, we're under pressure to be relevant. But when they mean relevant, you know, they mean something quite different than teaching us strategies for transforming the world. Relevance has increasingly become, I need to get a good job because, you know, college is so expensive. I'm on huge loans. I need to immediately get a job when I leave, so I'm going to take accounting. Or I'm going to take, like, you know, whatever is economics. On my campus, everybody studies economics. You know, one of the worst things to study, everybody studies economics. Or pre-med, you know. Which is, you know, I'm absolutely fine with pre-med. What I recommend you look at, by the way, speaking of pre-med, is a report from the South Asian Public Health Associates. The website is saphaa.org, I think. They brought out something called the Brown Papers a few months ago about the health of South Asian America. And how, for instance, here's one little detail which I personally am interested in. South Asian men have the highest rate of heart disease in the United States. You know, so it's always a good idea not to get too worked up, you know. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, I'm not sure what's better, you know, giving up bacon or, you know, giving up politics, you know. Somebody once told me doesn't like to read the newspapers because it agitates her, you know. I find that. Anyway. So the first thing that I'm interested in us thinking about is more marrying of the politics and the community service. It's extremely important. I just want to read something that I brought. You know, we often think of the working class in the United States as being people who need us, you know, who need intellectuals, and who basically, you know, you go there and, like, you're supposed to feel good for being, you know, in a working class organization, you know, because, I mean, it's a weird thing, right? You know, we believe in social justice, but also we know that we have huge amount of opportunities in our life. So we feel that if we take off from the beaten track and go and work for an organization, you know, somebody owes me, you know, for being so good in the world, you know, and somebody needs to pat my back and, you know, whatever. Do you know what I mean? The sense that, you know, I'm sacrificing myself for poor people. You know, but really the working class, in a sense, has figured out a lot of things itself. And let me just read from a description. This is Ethel Long Scott, who works for the Women's Economic Agenda Project in Oakland, describing one of the movement leaders in their organization. One of our strongest leaders, she's a mother of six. She's a deep thinker. She's been really trying to figure out what does it take to get power and to change a situation. A great deal of this work involves a fairly intellectual pursuit. That means the willingness to sit down and think through a process. The other part is understanding how power is held in this country. Discipline is the other part of this plan to obtain the kind of information we need. We have all kinds of buddy systems set up. We have a book exchange between our networks, and if somebody gets hold of a good historical piece, we share it. We don't back away from the fact that there has to be a fundamental change. For us, that's an ongoing effort. The whole community is a university for us. Everybody brings something to the table, and there's potential. How do we get to that talent, that light of dignity? That's different from saying, we've got to rehabilitate this person. So let me have us think of this question. How do we get to that talent, that light of dignity? In a sense, I hope that those of us who join in this building of the South Asian American left think less about rehabilitating people who we think is misfortunate and more about our community as a university for us. Everybody brings something to the table, and that's potential. You bring something, the working class brings something, you know, I bring something, we all bring something, and that's potential, and we bring different things. Different people have different skills. Paulo Freire, the great Brazilian writer, educator, thinker, wrote a book called Anthropology of the Oppressed, a Pedagogy of the Oppressed, a great book, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. He narrates a story how he went into the highlands in Brazil, in the northeastern Brazil, not highlands, in northeastern Brazil, and he was talking to farmers there, landless workers in the fields. And so he said, you know, people were all just sitting quietly and listening to him, and nobody was talking. And then he said, let's play a game. And he said, the game is this. You ask me a question, and if I don't know the answer, you win a point, and then I'll ask you a question, and then et cetera. So Freire said, let me start. And he asked him, he said, what is Dante's most famous book? And the farmer was like, screw this, I don't know. So Freire says, I get a point. Then the farmer says, okay, this guy's playing heavy, you know. He says, okay, when do you plant the sugarcane crop? And Freire says, I don't know, so one all. Then the next question, what's Shakespeare's most famous play? And the farmer's like, I don't know. And then the farmer says to him, okay, so it's 2-1. How do you stop the police from entering our fields? You know, everybody brings something to the table, and that's potential. How do we get that talent, that light of dignity? That's different from saying we've got to rehabilitate this person. Everybody brings something, and that's potential. Our entry into these struggles isn't because we are in some ways special, but because we are part of that community, which is the university. And I think it's our goal, in a sense, to ask ourselves this question: how do we get that talent, that light of dignity? How do we overturn the world that Hayek has given us and produce something more beautiful? So, you know, you have 2 days. Enjoy yourselves and, struggle. All right.